Hi everyone, welcome back to the Arkademia podcast. Today's episode is a consultant's masterclass. We'll be discussing what consultants are required at each REBA stage, how to work with them, and what the outcomes should be. Enjoy. Right, let's jump straight into it then. So, consultants, REBA stage one, go.
All of them. the end.
Sadly, that's not the world we live in, but it's real world in terms of like client sort of expectations. What, where do you start?
Go on. We'll go first.
Typically how it would work for us is a client will come to us and say, can you appraise or do a feasibility on this site? And at that stage, and rightly so, they don't often own the site, so they don't want to outlay any fees, which are then a risk that they're not going to get back. So at a push, we can probably at stage 0 to 1 do it off an OS plan. You know, if it's a conversion of a, like if they want to see how many numbers they can get in an existing building, we would struggle. It's a bit of a pointless exercise. And we probably would say we would need an existing survey or some type of hint to what it looks like internally. So at that stage, it's not recommended, but you probably can get by off an OS, can't you, if it's a piece of land?
Yeah, the key is just to warn, isn't it? The key is just always to caveat that, you know, it's subject to a topographical survey or whatever. And we have got notes just so we don't forget anyone. And we have put topographical survey here as an ideal. It is ideal, isn't it? That really, you know, you should be getting a topo survey, but you can live with an OS. And in terms of cost, you mentioned, we would go to what's it called? UK CAD map or something like that. The client picks up the bill for that, for the OS map, obviously. And then we can appraise it from that point. We've got loads of templates now, haven't we? We've got loads of appraisal templates and all that sort of stuff, which, you know, we'll share with whoever asks for it. And that streamlines the process. You know, it's a hot topic that you mentioned about fees and stuff like that. It's a tricky one to call it free work because you are appraising the site where the client is at risk. You know, they haven't bought the thing. So we do sort of understand why a developer wouldn't want to spend a lot at that point. And how we've dealt with that is by making that as slick as possible, haven't we? Yeah. We've got templates, we've got things that give us just a sense of, you know, what a site can take capacity-wise. And we've got over 300 projects now that we can call on as well.
We could probably share what that would typically look like as well, you know, at that stage, the deliverable, because you don't want to be putting like doors and windows and stuff on your drawing because that just takes time. Yeah. You just want to be doing block zones, and the client wants to know how many numbers and what's my net to gross.
And sometimes we'll draw walls paper thin, and we just make sure that your areas are over egged by, you know, about 20%, something like that, just so you know you're building that fat in. So we could actually share.
So in terms of consultants, sorry, for the podcast,
one. But just for the purpose of this as well, we're just going to keep it to one to five, because really stage zero is a coffee with the clients, isn't it? So there's not much going on there. And then stages 6 and 7 are like handover, which again, that's contracting and all that sort of stuff. So 1 to 5 is the bulk of this discussion. And just to get to the point, as you say, for consultants, we are saying a surveyor, a contract admin and a project manager. And the contract admin and project manager might seem a little heavy handed, but it's never too early to discuss procurement routes, what might the contract be eventually, what's the form of contract with all the consultants, all that sort of stuff. And a good project manager from day one as well are absolutely worth the weight in gold.
For the clients as much as us.
They protect everyone. Yeah, they do protect everyone. And a good project manager, my favourite, we may as well do the odd shout outs because, you know, we're speaking very highly of people. So my favourite is a company called Spring & Co. And the difference I find to them amongst a lot of others I've worked with is they get really stuck in. So they've helped on complex projects with certain licensing agreements, or it might even be they get stuck in with like section agreements with local authorities and things like that. So if you get a good project manager from day one, they can kind of free you up to design.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So, you know, keep your focus.
Yeah, so what I would say at stage one, it's key to get a red line, because although this sounds really simple, it can often have implications that you don't realise if you don't get it correct. And then later down the line, it can really bite it on the behind if you haven't ascertained what your red line is. And then with that, any additional title information, which will then include like any restricted covenants or easements across the site.
So Dana, you wouldn't put that on a consultant though, or would you? It's more client responsibility.
It's more client responsibility to give it to them, but often they won't. So you have to tell them, does it have any of this, this, and this? Has this came up in your legals? Because a lot of the times, like an easement, say there's a drain across the site, it will have like an easement, like 5 meters either side or 2 meters either side or whatever. That you can't build. So having these established at the earliest possible moment basically allows you to, the site designs itself, because there's only certain amounts of places you can put road, houses, apartments, and...
Well, you generate a constraints plan, don't you? First.
Yeah, and the constraints plan is key.
We should have mentioned that really, before you appraise something, generate a constraints plan on the back of that. And one big message we're trying to get across today is you can massively streamline your own process by letting other consultants do a little bit of the thinking for you, a little bit of the work for you. And at this point, you should really insist that a solicitor relays some of that key information to you. The conveyance solicitor on the site or the client, you know, whatever. But you know, that's normally the source when they do the searches. Something when you buy a house, they do tell you those things, don't they?
Yeah.
So there's nothing stopping them doing the equivalent on the start of a project, and then that will inform the constraints plan.
And on the flip side, like some solicitors, there's only key things you're probably looking for at this stage. Some will give you like a document with like 500 pages. You need to just say, I'm appraising this, just give me the headlines. Because otherwise you can spend 2 days digesting the document and none of it's relevant.
I haven't tested it yet, but Adobe have rolled out this AI thing within PDFs now. And it does, one of the main things at the top, it gives you some standard buttons. I only saw it yesterday. And it said, would you like me, it's like, you know, someone's like speaking first person, would you like me to summarise this document? So I might give that a try next time and see what happens. Yeah. But I'd be nervous, I would double check it myself. Yeah. Or just say, get it from source. You shouldn't really, a lot of consultants, clients, whatever, they fall into the trap of thinking the architect does everything.
Yeah.
And one of the main messages today is that it couldn't be further from the truth. We don't do everything. We kind of orchestrate everything, but we don't do everything. And in this instance, try and just, you know, dig your heels in a little bit and say, that's not for me. It's not for me to read a 500 page document. It's for the person who done the searches and created the document to give me that summary. We'll all be better off.
And the best way to summarise something is on a drawing. So don't tell me, like in text, where an easement is. Show me on a drawing and you know exactly what you're dealing with. I had a similar scenario yesterday. So planning came back on one of my projects and they said I need to design a couple of parking spaces to this certain standard. And I looked at the document and it was like 80 pages and then it just basically summarised to that drawing. And that at certain stages, that's all you want, because it can become overwhelming to be like swallowed up in text, can't it?
In
terms of working with the consultant then, so, you know, contract admin.
Getting it back on track.
we'll do this all the way through, but contract admin and project managers, they're nice to haves, and we'll touch on how important they are in the later stages. But, you know, it is great if you have them on stage one, not always possible. But so for stage one, working with this particular consultant, a topographical surveyor, for someone who's never done it before, what's the process?
Good question.
I've actually done it this morning. just met one on site.
So another thing we were saying before we started was about if anyone listening to this wants a bit of advice on who to go to and stuff, just get in touch and we can provide that. And I think we will probably include some of that in courses that come this year as well. But if anyone needs a contact, just give us a shout. We've got loads now, and it is about reaching out to three. Seems to be the magic number, isn't it? So reach out to three surveying companies. And the word surveyor, it means loads of things, doesn't it? So this one is a measured surveyor or a topographical surveyor. And you go to them and, you know, they can do Revit models and everything, can't they? Point clouds, laser scans, everything. But at the very, very least, It's about asking for a quote for floor plans, elevations, sections, ideally, and a site plan that gives you whale coordinates and it gives you levels.
And what that basically is doing is it's giving you the site digitally on your screen. Otherwise, you can't.
Where do you start?
You can't do it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Another little alternative, this comes with risk, but another alternative is if you work on an OS map, it has the odd spot level, doesn't it? The odd spot level. And a nice thing that where I've been like absolutely starved of information, SketchUp has this geolocate tool. And what I've done in the past, when I say stage one, I would never get to do this outside of stage one, but I've used the geolocate tool with some key levels from an OS map just to get a sense of the slope of the site. You're not far off by, you know, if a site is sloped, it will give you that information. Generally speaking, it should go nowhere near a plan application or definitely construction, but it's not a bad little fallback. If you're absolutely starved of a surveyor or a consultant or whatever, it's not a bad starting point just to get a sense of, is there a gradient on the site and how to work with it. And that's it really, isn't it? There's not many consultants. You can almost live without consultants as long as you've got a clear brief from the client and you're doing that initial appraisal and you're aware of the constraints.
I find minimum space standards has helped in that regard as well, because before they were widely adopted, you'd spend the first 2 weeks trying to ascertain from the client what size they wanted the apartment. Yeah. Whereas now it's minimum space standard. So it's taking that element out of it. You do it to that. And then they're normally large enough to accommodate M42.
Yeah.
And obviously we're coming from a residential angle. I think generally we come from a residential angle because that's our bread and butter.
Yeah.
And I'd probably say that's probably the most common kind of sector people are working in. So we are going to come from that angle, but the principles still apply, don't they, to everything else. There are standards for schools, hospitals, whatever, you know what I mean? So just work to those standards, as Jack said there. And again, you know, we've actually, one of our members, we talked them through an appraisal, didn't we, remember, John? So we talked them through it as well. So again, you know, that we can give that advice if you need it, sort of thing.
And then the outcome then of stage one, after working with your topographical surveyor, ideally if you've got one on, is then to just finalise your feasibility with your client and confirm that the client's happy with what you've drawn and you're ready to move to stage two.
Revisit the brief though as well. Yeah. So the appraisal / feasibility, it's the same thing. You might say a Kenny Collins. I use, because sometimes the brief's dead vague, isn't it, when you get it. So sometimes you use the appraisal to just weed out the brief. I'm doing it at the minute on a job. And then you use that to then go back to them with and say, does this represent the brief? It's a nice stage to just nail that. Because if you continually evolve in the brief as you go, it's knackering. So it's nice to just revisit the brief, get it in writing that's the brief. And then really from that point, you are in kind of the billing stages, aren't you? Which I should say, we'll get into stage two.
Yeah. So then, REBA stage two, design sort of agreed in its earliest stage. Where do you go from there? What consultants are you looking at immediately when you move into that stage, which is obviously concept design, and then during or the end of that stage would be maybe a pre-app submission to the local council. So what do you need then to achieve the end of that stage?
So the pre-app process, it's probably evolved quite a lot over the last 3 or 4 years, and it sort of just used to get dismissed a bit, didn't it, Adam? But now it's very heavily involved process.
Something we've embraced though as well, haven't we? To be fair, I think we nail pre-apps now, though.
Yeah, so we like to front end the pre-app process with as much information and as much thought as possible. So basically, when you get to stage three and it's the planning app, a lot of it in theory should be done.
Yeah.
It's not always the case, but that's the idea behind.
Or at the very least, the more robust your submission is, the more robust the comments are. You just know where you stand.
Yeah.
And pre-applications, for anyone that doesn't know, pre-applications are an early discussion. It is a submission. It is a paid submission, but it's more of a dialogue with the local authority that isn't in the public realm. So you can keep things behind closed doors. There's no real need to consult too many statutory consultees, local resident groups and all that sort of stuff. It's just your first crack at the thing. But we, as Jack said there, it's got more prominence over the definitely the last 5 or 6 years, you know, in our operation. But we've embraced that by almost turning our pre-apps into mini design and access statements. And we've seen a lot of success because we do have to convince clients of a bit more fee up front, yes. But they've all seen the benefits, haven't they, of that the streamlined process afterwards. To answer your question, bring it back on topic. For me, the first two are planning and heritage. Heritage being if it's needed. But you know what? More often than not, especially in Liverpool, a heritage consultant is near enough needed all the time because there are wider heritage impacts, aren't there? You know, in our city, like on the cathedrals and things. So there's always heritage to it. Doesn't have to be a list of buildings to have heritage.
And there's a crossover with heritage to other areas as well, because there's more often than not, they will do a townscape and visual impact assessment, but sometimes the landscape architects can do them as well.
Yeah, it does kind of thing.
And if you're dealing with a building of height, you probably want to start introducing them type of conversations so early into the pre-app process.
So would you say that's an absolute must at stage two?
It's not a must because it will get appraised without it, but the response back will be limited.
Yeah. So it's always better to do it so you can get those comments back from the planners earlier rather than then getting it all back at stage three and having to do a lot of work then.
Well, there's too much catching up to do, isn't there? So you're better off assessing visual impact at that stage. Even if, and again, this is why we do push the idea of architects having at least a level of rendering capability, because you can actually create those views yourself. You can't do the assessment yourself. That's important. Architects aren't necessarily qualified to do the assessment, but there's nothing stopping us doing an accurate 3D model to represent the views. So again, if in the absence of the appropriate consultants, you could still create those views. And then again, just caveat it by saying just subject to a final assessment. But plan a consultant first. What's a use class? You know, things like that. Is the use class relevant to the site? I suppose you should really know that yourself, but planning consultant gives you the definitive on that. Heritage gives you a sense of, again, that kind of wider impact. And there are consultants that do give urban advice as well, aren't there? Now, that could be a planning consultant as well, as in like maybe a bigger consultancy would have like an urban sort of urban designer maybe in there that can give you a little bit of a sense of that. We've got a guy in Liverpool, I forget his name now, we've got a guy in Liverpool who helps with a little bit of urban commentary as well from our side. But you often find that comes from planning consultants, heritage, landscape. That's it. So he's brilliant about, he used to work at the council in that kind of urban position, and he just does give you a little bit of advice on urban impact. Can you justify that height? Can you justify that type of use class? You know, is it a corner site? Is it a middle site? All that sort of stuff.
Yeah. So, which is key at stage two.
It's massive.
It's all about height really at stage two, particularly in Liverpool, because the more height, the more units, the better the building.
Well, and bulk, I think. And bulk as well. Massing isn't just vertical height, it is chunk as well, isn't it? You know what I mean? How chunky is it? But then what I find is a planning consultant almost becomes in this window the project manager. So you still could have a project manager, of course, running the entire thing. But I like that a few favourite planning consultants of mine who really do embrace the role of, right, I'm going to dictate the submission. What are we submitting and when? And you know what I mean? And what's the tone? Are we expecting an appeal here? Are we expecting to be laughed out the room? So we have done those schemes where we're expecting confrontation. So we pitch everything as if we're going to go straight to an appeal. Mm. That's so important. And the architect doesn't really advise on that. The planning consultant gives that. And the planning consultant also recommends legal advice. I must admit, I get a little confused with King's Chambers, Queen's Chambers, lots of stuff, but just top lawyers, basically. And they just give this amazing advice on, you know, have you got grounds for this at appeal? You know, it's absolutely brilliant. I've had a real top lawyer from, I think it was a KC or a QC, and he read my design and access statement top to bottom and just reworded it so it was better fit for an appeal process. Brilliant. Yeah. Absolutely brilliant. But that's not for the architect to advise, that's for the planning consultant to advise. So you can almost take all that worry away from yourself then. Again, the message here is about keeping you nice and focused on the design. All that advice comes as long as you're aware of these consultants.
So in terms of working then with the consultants, you've explained like a lot of what the planning consultant does, but for us working with them, are you just off the bat, you get introduced, planning consultants appointed, send them an email and send them the information we've drawn today
and
just
that,
say, critique that against policy, tell me where I need to change.
That's it.
And that's how it impacts our day job then, is he's away doing all the stuff you've just been talking about, that's his role. But in terms of how they affect our role at stage two, it's just feeding in potential policy comments so that we have to reiterate.
And then the beauty is, even though we are going to recommend some now, the beauty is a real good planning consultant also then drafts a team list and says, I think on this site, you know, we've done a few housing schemes that are really landscape led. So not every project needs like a landscape consultant this early, but some do. And a planning consultant will say, definitely need landscape on this. Definitely need, I'm trying to think of others, you know, drainage, you know, civils and all that sort of stuff. They generally recommend it. And they'll have half an eye on the validation checklist as well.
Yeah.
You know, they'll be thinking, if we get as much of the validation checklist dealt with for pre-app, we're onto a winner for the full app. Yeah. And again, for anyone who's not familiar, a validation checklist is a set of documents that allows the submission of an application, you know, from payments to the actual case officer's desk.
Different planning consultants will take a different view on it as well. So I've worked with some who will let you put a scheme in quite bare so you get an invalid letter. And then it tells you exactly what you need.
Oh, so you let them tell you.
And then the client isn't like forking out potential risks in terms of consultants and stuff. I find it's not the best process because it's more of a reactive process then. Whereas if you go in and you've considered every possible avenue, you will still come to like discussion points that you need to address and get over, but you're generally in a better place if you know you're hitting the validation list from the offset.
And what we're getting at here is, again, we're early in the process, so a lot of the clients that you deal with, they don't want to be paying for stuff that they might not need.
Yeah.
So we're always banging the drum of appoint everyone as early as possible, but clients at that stage, sometimes they don't even own the site. Sometimes they've only got an option on the site. So they're like, I don't really want to pay, you know, $5,000-$10,000 on that consultant when the site's still at risk for me. The pre-app might come back and they might just say flat, no, you can't develop on this site. You know, it's very rare that would happen, but there still is risk there for the developer. So that's exactly what you're saying. Some planning consultants, if they're aware that clients might not want to fork out at that point, there's ways and means that you can sort of run the system that they, you know, that exact scenario there. He's getting the response from the planners of exactly what consultants
need. I find going for the invalid letter approach, it tends to hold the job up substantially. So we've had jobs like church conversions before, haven't we, where the particular client hasn't wanted to fork out on consultants. So they've waited for the invalidation checklist, but we've been like of the advice, it's a listed building, so we can see quite a lot of these. We know you're going to need a heritage appraisal and stuff, and they don't go for it thinking
they might get lucky.
But it's not really. It doesn't really work like that.
Some of them are obvious, aren't they? Some of them are obvious, and then what happens is it's invalid, and then it can get lost in the system then as well. And by the way, this probably is the right time to explain that we are at the type of practice that we prefer to consultant heavy, I would say. There are inefficiencies in having too many consultants. There is too many cooks and all sorts of stuff, yes. But in our experience, 7 years now as practice owners, in our experience, we've seen both, haven't we? We've seen no team and we've seen huge teams. And generally the huge teams are more successful. There is a sweet spot, but the larger the team, generally the better. So just to be clear to everyone, we're coming from a bit of an angle of realism as well, aren't we? But the general advice is there's never too many and it's never too early. Yeah. Simple as that. And on a recent pre-application, because we have reserved engineers of all kinds for stage three, but we did make a little asterisk to say that in stage two, if it's the right sort of clients, we work with a handful of housing associations and they're more experienced, they're more of an expert client. They're an easier type of client to convince that you need certain appraisals doing. And I recently submitted a pre-application with a full plant room design. It had full ductwork design, risers. It had a structural model, Revit model. You know, it was still in principle, but it was coordinated for stage two for a pre-app. And you should have seen the response we got. The more serious you take it, the more serious they take you. Simple as that. The pre-app came back quicker. We had a couple of great video calls, a couple of real good sessions on it. And you could just see that, you know, they knew we were taking it more serious. And that my general advice would be to that push for as many consultants as possible and at least get the specialist appraisal. We submitted a fire statement and everything for pre-app. So when it come back, it pretty much was no comment.
Yeah.
Consultant coordination is pretty much the top and bottom of it once you get out of planning as well. So to not do it pre-planning is a bit of an own goal because it will always lead to changes where you then have to more often than not go back into planning.
Always a resubmission.
And then it ends up costing you here a lot more than, you know, paying for it initially at stage 1 to 3. Once you get into stage 4, once you've got the consent, it's so much more costly to the project in terms of time, money, and I just wouldn't advise.
100%, I think.
You just sense his frustration and he's speaking from live experience.
So, like, I mean, the next stage, or Reba stage 3, we've got basically all the sort of mega important ones there. But to just sort of put a line under your point there, you should be insisting that structural engineers, civils, fire, all of that stuff has to come pre-planning at some point, whether it's stage 3 or stage 2, it has to come before you plan an application.
And the thing I wanted to emphasise was there is such a thing as a structural appraisal. There's such a thing as a drainage appraisal, a mechanical appraisal. So these are all dotted lines on a drawing, right?
Yeah.
So they're quite quick to produce. And I'm not trying to undermine other professions there, because a lot of work in the background does take place, of course. But the end product just gives you that confidence that just things like, again, resubmissions of, like, you know, the depth of your structural zone, the depth of your ductwork zone, that does affect building height. Mm. That affects massing. So the amount of schemes I've had to put back in, or there's plants on the roof,
and you
put it back in. So we're just a bit more mature now, aren't we? That we now know how to explain it better. We know how to convince clients better now that you will pay for it dearly in the long run. And a developer often pays interest on a site, and so time is literally money. So it's a good way of explaining to a client that you will actually speed the entire process up by doing it right this early. But in the absence of that, which does happen, it's just all about flagging it as a risk, isn't it?
Yeah.
That duty of care thing that an architect has to demonstrate is, I think it's 3 steps. It's the initial advice, it's a follow-up, and then the third one is you're at risk.
Yeah.
And you could do a project risk register and say, right, I've advised now that we need this, 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 and this. Get it in writing, get it on a schedule, send it off. And then if they then don't go for it, I personally think those 3 steps, you've demonstrated your duty of care, and as long as you're going into the plan application, everyone's clear, then if it's a resubmission, it doesn't come back to you, sort of thing.
Just want to really quickly, before we move into stage 3, which is going to be one of the bigger parts of the podcast, you mentioned heritage consultant there in stage 2. What does working with a heritage consultant sort of entail? What's their feedback? How does that impact your work?
Obviously, but similar. I mean, to be fair, we haven't got tons of time, have we? So similar to planning. So and this applies to every consultant, I think, actually, or generally speaking, anyway, is the and Jack touched on it before. As long as you can get it in some sort of drawn medium, ideally. Or even if it's like maybe you jump on a video call or something and maybe you can be the draftsman, but, you know, they can advise it. They give you the feedback on, you know, are you allowed to make these decisions? Are you allowed to make these moves on, you know, say it's a listed building. Can you demolish that wall? Can you can you, you know, what? And actually, that's why it's not terrible to not have that at stage one, because you could almost be overly restricted, you know, in a way. You can just, let's just try and demonstrate the client's brief first, yeah, and then use that then as a document or a drawing to just issue out then to the other consultants. And every single one generally just feeds back with their own lens.
Yeah.
So Heritage is the exact same. They would just say, it can't be done, it can be done, I can support this, I can't support that.
You can't replace the windows, you can't replace the windows.
Yeah, exactly. Which is, and if you're going to replace the windows, it has to look like this.
Yeah.
You know, the old Georgian window, all the 6/6 stuff. Yeah. You know, they tell you all that. So it's about getting that advice. And what happens is, if you do it right, so again, if anyone's listening to this and you just want a bit more information or whatever, you just follow up with us. Because... we have got a list, actually, haven't we? We have got a standard list that we, you know, at what stage and stuff. But generally speaking, you get enough people around you of good quality and good nature as well. People who do want to, you know, team players. You just end up with this lovely framework and constraints, as Jack said earlier. Constraints are a framework, so you get that as a framework and you work to that. And I touched on this little saying of like, it gives you the guardrails,
yeah,
to just work. If you work to the advice of all your consultants, generally speaking, as long as you can produce a nice piece of architecture while you're there, you're on to a winner. So similar, yeah. So similar to planning.
Yeah, good. Yeah. So we'll get into the big one then. So outcomes of stage two are you submit your pre-app and then you get your advice back. That then starts to form the basis of what the scheme's going to look like for planning. And at this point, this is where we get strong, especially in our office, if we haven't already, on all the other key consultants. So I'll let you guys run through what those are.
We literally have to read these out, don't we? Because there's that many now. So I was at a session, was it yesterday or the day before, with Liverpool City Council, and they were explaining about there's a new validation checklist now. It's getting stricter. It's getting more towards better quality design. And I'm all for it. It will make our job trickier earlier in, but all it does is speak to what we're trying to say today. It just brings that wider team in. It brings that better assessment in early doors, which is not only the way, it's the best way to do it. So again, just a caveat that all these consultants I'm going to just reel off now should really be at stage two, but an absolute must at stage three. And I also like that the RIBA have changed the name of this stage to spatial coordination.
Yeah, so it used to be developed design.
It used to be developed design. I think it used to be stage, back in our day, it used to be like stage D or something,
yeah,
like that.
It was D, wasn't it?
I do like that it's changed the numbers actually as well. So it's called spatial coordination. And the idea is you've done your appraisal, you've done your concept as well. So it's took that step further. They're proper architectural drawings now, and you've got your pre-app feedback, let's just say.
Yeah.
You know, so you've got that feedback, you've got your confidence going into the plan application. Now what? For me, my advice is always, let's have a dry run at stage four now. That's how I like to treat stage three. So if it wasn't done at two, so those structural appraisals, if they weren't done at two, then they've got to be done 100%, got to be done now, structural appraisals, if not go a step further. So let's see a proper coordination process. Again, you know, the client's appetite does vary, but I think the way it's going, it's going to become, you know, you've got no option. And particularly fire engineer, the gateways that have come in now that you need to pass, they're now becoming part of the planning process. So again, I'm all for that. So to just list the consultants off, your planning consultant obviously carries through. Your heritage consultant carries through. We didn't touch on quantity surveyor.
Viability at stage two is actually quite big.
Viability comes into it. Again, that straddles two and three. So you've got a quantity surveyor, maybe even an estate agent who gives you a bit of evaluation. You'd be amazed how many people are involved in a building. And we did sort of say about geotechnical reports and stuff, but I think that's more of a survey. That's, you know, site investigation stuff. In terms of pure consultants, planning consultant carries over, heritage, QS. Then we've got structural and civil engineer, fire engineer, MEPH, by the way, I like to throw the H at the end, mechanical, electrical, plumbing and heating, just so the client knows that we don't do radiators, mm-hmm. even though Jack's drawing them at the minute. Civil engineer, acoustician, energy consultant, environmental consultant, ecologist, transport, and we've also thrown in right to light. There are other ones to do with right to light, like party wall, and little disputes like that. So, you know, those sort of things, right to life, party wall and things like that. And the idea, because that, well, and landscape actually as well, it sounds like a huge list, but you'd be amazed that as long as the architectural scheme is in the right sort of place, no individual role there has to be huge. It's just a case of checking the architectural and giving it a good sense check. Is the plant room in the right place? Is it the most efficient place? Are we making the right sort of allowances for just rises and things like that? Spatial coordination. That's why it's called that, because have you got the right zones for it, I suppose, the best way of doing
it? It's not quite technical design yet, is it? As you say, you're not in stage four yet. It is about just, have you got the space? Exactly what you just said.
Yeah, like if it's sprinkled, how much tank storage do you need and can you spatially fit it in?
Yeah.
That is probably one of the best examples, actually. A sprinkler tank is massive. And, you know, if you do a planning application and you're not getting that advice, I mean, you can have a wild guess at it. Mm-hmm. But if you're not getting that advice of planning, it's automatically going to be a resubmission, whether it's a non-material amendment, Section 73, or a full application. I've seen that before. And it's devastating to the process.
Yeah. And I suppose at this point now is where serious DTMs coming in, design team meetings. So you should be having them earlier. But again, if you haven't got loads of consultants appointed, it's more just like client meetings in the first few stages. But stage three, you should be having them consultants appointed, kickoff meeting. Right, we're getting ready for a planning app. Everyone feed in, here's where it's at. All go away and look at it. Start marking it up, give us it back. Mm-hmm. And that's basically, I keep trying to bring it back for people who've got no experience in this whatsoever. If you've never worked with consultants before, you might not even know what a MEPH does, you know what I mean? It'd be good if you can go into a little bit of that. If we'd be here all night, if we talked about everything,
no one wants to talk about
anything. No, but I suppose you were trying to cover it off earlier when you said they all work in a similar way. You're basically just sending them your plans to get back with their specialist advice, because their specialist way not.
And at this stage, the application is only as good as the weakest bit of information. And what I mean by that is I'm quite advanced in a project, and it was very consultant heavy, which was good. But in one particular area, it was landscaping. They said, will you have a go at that? And I said, well, I can do you a landscape plan based on my experience in the past, but it won't be endorsed by the local authority. And when they start asking for like species of tree, roots, zones and stuff, I will fall short. And they said, okay, yeah, let's get it valid. Got it valid. And then very late in the application, it reared its head. It became an issue. And whereas that wouldn't have taken any time, it probably added about 6 to 8 weeks on sourcing a landscape architect, getting them to now work to a scheme that was rigid, because it was all set, the parking was set and stuff. And yeah, that's what I mean by you're only as strong as your weakest.
It's really, really, really good point, because what we're saying here is it all comes back to the only person who's going to come down on you is the client. And how does it affect the client, that, like, when they get this stuff wrong, if you appoint a consultant too late in the process? Yeah. And what you've just said there, that particular job, if you've had most of the consultants on and just left one, if all those other consultants have signed off the design, everyone's happy.
Yeah.
And then you bring that one on late because the council have asked
for
it.
But it's no less
and
important.
And it affects everyone's work. Yeah. So when they come in and go, the whole design team's got to get back together. And that, as you say, could take 8, 10, 12 weeks. And then the client's pulling their hair out going, what, I was on a committee next week to get this approved, and now I've got to wait 3 months for the next time I can get on.
That, as a scenario, is exactly what I meant to hear about, that kind of three-step duty of care thing. Jack warned the clients on those three occasions that were shy on this area.
Yeah.
So when it come back and everyone was panicking, not once did the client think of blaming us. They just sort of said, yeah, you know,
you warned us.
Yeah, and let's get on with it. Yeah. And actually, that does help for the solution-based attitude, because it's not, well, you know, why didn't someone advise me?
Your mentality as project architects, we're obviously, a lot of the time, we're appointed as lead designer. And that's an important definition, isn't it? Because basically, our job is made a lot easier by all the consultants we work with. But we are the lead, aren't we? So we might not be an expert in all those areas, but we're managing that for them. And that speaks to exactly what we're talking about here.
We are the orchestrator of everyone else's advice. My philosophy is I try and let the other consultants do one pass initially, as long as the architectural solution is resolved enough at stage two. Mm. I then distribute that and say, do your best to work with it. Anything that you can't do and I have to move, let me know, make it clear, make that in red, right? Make it clear. And then I'll do my absolute best to, you know, almost bend the architecture to suit your constraints. To give you a very direct one, to use M&E as an example, you need risers through a building. A riser, I didn't know what a riser was when I was younger. A riser is basically a hole through the building that has a little cabinet door on every floor, and it's for drainage, it's for electrics, it's, you know, whatever. And at one point in time, when I was less experienced, I wouldn't allow for riser space. And to get an M&E consultant on board to say, I need these types of cupboards, I need these meters, electric meters, water meters, and just give you a nice little zone, little box, width of door, because access is important. So you give you width of door, height of door, zone, mark it on the plan, you will allocate the zone, bang, that's enough for stage three.
And that's in 2D plan. It also is an issue in section, because the new, to pass the new building regs and new like SAP calcs or SBEM, you need like MVHR or what, or ground source heat pumps or whatever, and the ducting for them is bigger.
Right.
So you need to drop the ceilings more, and that also needs to then speak to the acoustic treatments. Like, you're dropping the ceilings to fit the surfaces, but you also need to fit like a layer of insulation. And to not know what that's going to be at planning, you could be scoring a massive own goal.
Yeah.
Again, that's a terminology you use with clients, isn't it? Don't be scoring an own goal. Is the project being judged against an energy assessment like a BREEAM? Because then that's another layer then. Yeah. You know what I mean? There's more, well, actually the thermal regs are changing very soon as well. And, you know, so it affects thermal, it affects so much. So before you know it, the building could be 10 stories, but it could go from 30 metres to 40 metres, you know, depending on this input.
And that's the difference between getting planning and not getting planning in some instances.
Or the planning that's bollocks because it's another 10 metres taller further down the line.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
And then I'm almost selling it to you. I don't need to sell it to you. But everything just comes off the back of it, doesn't it? A really good stage three, solid stage three, just makes stage four so much easier. And what I'm tempted to do, because I don't think we will do everything, you know what I mean, absolutely everything on this session, I think we will share this list, maybe in the description of this video or this podcast.
Well, why don't we give like typical deliverables at key stages? So what would we send out at stage one, two, three, four?
So that's what I'm saying. So we'll have a think separately and maybe we'll add a few little attachments to this.
What does our DNA statement look like?
Well, what's a download pack? Do you need to buy that?
Well, you've got to be a member.
Or that.
Sign up today.
So the key message here, just so we can move into the next stage, the key message here is stage three is your full team, isn't it? It's your full team, really. And if we haven't made it clear yet, we will attach some sort of download or whatever to this. Yeah. I don't know whether you can do it on Spotify. I'll have to check, but you can on YouTube anyway.
Yeah.
So if you're listening on Spotify, go to YouTube and I will leave a link to some documents just to give that list. We've got a nice schedule, haven't we, and stuff.
Can it live in the freebie area of the website if you're going to give it away?
Possibly. I'll have a think.
We'll sort it out.
So I
want to keep us going on stage three a little bit because it is the big one. I think once you've done your stage three right, the rest of the project is easy to run, isn't it?
I don't know about that.
To keep you in, I want to sort of put you under pressure a little bit to sort of answer a few. What are your most important? So like, if you had to pick, out of all the lists we've just mentioned there, if you had to pick the three biggest before you submit planning, you know, is it structures, civils, fire? Is it M&E? You know, what can't you live without for stage three?
Planning consultant, fire and highways would be mine.
We haven't mentioned highways / transport consultant. Or did I?
You can't get it validated without it and passed. You can without structure and M&E. So although
So by the way, just for clarity, I'm not saying don't get any of these others because you definitely need them.
Which is your camera? I think you're looking over there.
But yeah, I like 100%. Like you need them. Don't go for planning without them still. But yeah, I'm just trying to see what you guys think are the three most important.
But you can get planning without them. You can't get planning.
So that's a good answer.
Subject to the validation checklist, though. So the absolute textbook answer to that is check your local authorities validation checklist, because acoustics is getting more prominent now. So we have to do background, not us, but you know, you have to engage in a background noise survey, vibration surveys. You know, is it over a tunnel? There's loads of tunnels in Liverpool. So if it doesn't matter how good your maybe structural appraisal is, if you need the acoustics for validation, it just doesn't matter.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But we were having a discussion again before this, weren't we? My sort of the one that makes me breathe easier, and it's the opposite of what Jack just said, which is quite typical of me, is or you know, both of us, we do think quite differently, don't we? The one I like to just see is structures. Yeah. So I love it when, because you say I work mainly in Revit, and I just love seeing the structural model drop in. It makes the whole thing just look a bit more legit, a little bit more coordinated.
And but you would get planning without that.
You would. You? No, you would. You would. Yeah, no, it's
so
fair.
If you've got two, and Kenny said he's putting us under pressure, so you can only choose highways or structures. If you choose structures and not highways, you can't get planning.
No, but structural engineer might do me highways. But anyway, no. But so you are right. So it's no debate. Transport is a planning thing.
Requirement. Yeah.
Of course it is. Yeah. Because if there's no parking, the old car-free sort of developments, which is maybe for another day, you need a transport consultant to justify that with local surveys, you know, infrastructure, and that sort of stuff. Don't get me wrong. I'm more coming from I like it when the designs,
he said I could only pick three.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So when the design's resolved, you can just breathe more easily.
Yeah.
But yeah, structures, civils. I feel like when I get my structures and civils nailed, everything else falls from that. But
God, if you weren't an architect, this would be a boring podcast, wouldn't it?
that's why we're only doing architects.
I suppose the big scary one as well that I wanted to touch on is fire. So obviously there's gateways now that you have to pass at certain stages before it can move forward for building.
But the gateways only kick in if it's above 18 metres tall, the building.
So
keep your building below 18 metres tall.
Yeah. But we said we wouldn't get into that.
That's a whole different podcast.
Research gateways and stuff yourself.
Read my blog on the site and that.
Oh yeah. Oh, that's good. Yeah. But I'm sorry to just jump in there. Again, it's just a big, big message I want to get across on this podcast is, as an architect, you've got to have an understanding of everything. Of course you do. But if you've got a very good, and let's keep it to fire, as you've said, if you've got a top fire consultant on the project, generally speaking, you just revert to them.
I pick fire?
No.
Can I swap one for
you? Might, I don't know. I forgot. No, but they're all important. Thing, they're all important.
Yeah.
So on fire, I'm doing a lovely project in Leeds, I'm doing a sports centre in Leeds, and there's a debate as to whether the stair, it's a nice steel stair, open tread and all that sort of stuff. And, I need to check whether open tread's allowed still, but anyway.
No,
that's what I was thinking. I will sort that. My building regs will tell me that. So anyway, which we'll get to. But I've gone back to the fire engineer and said, I would like it to be open. And even if the regs say otherwise, maybe the fire engineer can engineer a solution. You know, is there other ways to protect that area to keep it free of being enclosed? So although I need to be mindful of not asking a silly question, as long as you've got a good team around you, you can rest easy knowing that you just put that question to the right person and you'll get the advice back. And generally speaking, you work the advice and you're laughing.
I don't think the open tread thing is a fire.
No, it's not. Yeah, I know.
So again,
just before we get trolled.
Yeah.
So, well, I think, you know, again, the people who aren't experienced who are listening to this podcast and who maybe haven't, you know, dealt with consultants before, a good question actually to you guys is probably when you first stepped into practice or when you were first a project lead in your practice, were you scared initially to work with other consultants?
Is it
a worry? Because I suppose the big message we're getting across here is consultants are your best friend. They're the ones you rely on for the specialist information. Again, speaking back to what you've just said, again, so important to remember that as lead designer, lead consultant, you're there to just manage the team, bring all that specialism together, aren't you? So they're your best mates. They're the ones telling you, no, you can't do that, yet you can do that. So they should be a comfort blanket to you. And I think eventually they probably are to you guys now. Yeah. But when you first sort of allowed to go and appoint your consultants and stuff, was it scary?
It's an intimidating thing. Like, yeah. And when you're at a meeting table with loads of different people who are basically talking binary code that you don't understand, it is intimidating. My mindset is, and I used to say this to some of like the part twos, if you didn't have any help or any support in the office, how would you do this on your own? And for example, a fire consultant, you'd ask him the questions and he would be a safety blanket for you. And it's that type of stuff. They're there to help you.
Yeah.
So
the fear is born out of embarrassing yourself. I know that for a fact. The fear of dealing with them is, will I ask a silly question? You know what I mean? Is it an obvious answer? Is it? That's always the fear, but it never is it?
No.
I still ask silly questions now. You know what I mean? Even to the point where I probably get the answer if I researched it myself. Sometimes I do it for a liability angle as well.
Yeah.
Sometimes I say, well, I need that advice from source.
Yeah.
That, you know what I mean? Whereas rather than making the call myself, sometimes it is about putting it in the right specialism. Yeah. Again, frees you up on other things. But it can be intimidating, and that does just come with experience, really.
You mentioned earlier to me before the podcast when we were green room chatting, yeah. You mentioned a particular personal experience that you had on your first job.
Yeah, yeah. Shout out to Phil Hirons, my man. He was the first structural civil. I don't know. Each individual has a specialism. It's either structures or civils in that type of company. But his company, I forget the name of the company now, but I'll never forget him. It was my first project where I was the project runner, or at the very least a project shadower. So it was one or the other, but either way, I had a role to play in, you know, coordination. And it was my first one, made a mess of it. And Phil was amazing, absolutely amazing. And not everyone is. I've dealt with some real, I mean, there's no other word for it, some knobhead engineers who try and embarrass the architect. There are consultants out there that think by embarrassing the architect, it makes themselves look more competent. They exist, they're out there, and you just got to keep a level head and just get on with it. But generally speaking, as you say, people are supportive, they are helpful. Everyone's just trying to do a good job at the end of the day.
It is quite scary as well when like you get a structural model back and you put it in and they say check it and you're like, what the fuck?
Now you probably never meant this, because I'm the one who's in charge of content. We've got a course coming on structural coordination. Bang. Like, you know,
Make sure you signed up for that.
So honestly, structural, no one's teaching that. Structural coordination. It's McCall, our lovely American architect. She's going to use ArchiCAD as the source, but the software is irrelevant.
It's the principle.
It's the principle of coordination. It's just that she uses ArchiCAD. So she's going to show you how to coordinate a frame in a BIM environment. It's going to be amazing.
I know you've said like it's easy after stage three, but stage four probably has got an hour on its own, hasn't it?
Yeah. So maybe, you know what I think we do? I do think maybe we do a part two, actually. I know we're very off the cuff here.
No, well, let's see how far we get, because I think we're almost towards the end of stage three now. You know, we've listed them all out. We've touched lightly. Well,
rather than rush stage four, because that is the majority of the fee, isn't it? I'd say.
Yeah, it is. It is when you go into to tender. And again, we've spoken, you know, at length about stage four can really be split into two, kind of. It could be split into 4A and 4B, depending on the stages of the tender.
I think we do two parts, actually. Just thinking about it now, this doesn't sound very professional, but just thinking about it now, I think we do reserve 4 and 5 for another day, because we've probably got another 5-10 minutes anyway on stage. So that's fine. That's, you know, because, you know, we don't want to bore everyone to death with the entire RABA plan away.
Yeah.
But we were just talking about the intimidation factor.
Is anyone awake?
Yeah. We were talking about the intimidation factor dealing with consultants. I do think that's something we can help with as well. We can make introductions. I think this is something that I think can be quite powerful with academia, is that we can, we were talking again about another story where my history of, before we set up RBA, my sector was education. I was doing schools left, right and centre. I had very little experience in residential. It kind of in my middle time, my last practice. It was towards the end of there. I did work on a few nice one-off houses. Going into practice, Jack's specialism was more the residential side. So we had a good few weeks, just a little crash course on, these are the things you need to look out for and whatever. And for those early months, I was actually checking in with Jack, and we still do it to this day, to be fair. We all check each other's stuff. But for those first few months, I was just checking in with Jack saying, is that about right? And what have you, interface distances and things like that. And one massive one that Jack did was he just said, here's a list of consultants, fill your boots. Here's transport, here's planning. Alan, Richard, you introduced me to all those people. Some of it was an email introduction. Some of it was just, here's the number, pick up the phone, tell them, you got it from me. And it's massive, isn't it? That intimidation factor just washes away when you do start to surround yourself with maybe three of each generally. And everyone knows, we know all them consultants work with other architects. It's a known thing in the industry. So if you have kind of three of each, more often than not, you end up with this lovely network, don't you, of people where you can just go to them. And sometimes it's just a little bit of ad hoc advice, isn't it? At stage one, you might just speak to a Philly planning consultant then and say, do you reckon I'm in the ballpark there?
Yeah.
And all that sort of stuff. So the intimidation factor, you can only deal with that with experience. But what I would say is the thing that we're trying to bring, if you like, to the market is you can get in touch with us and we can recommend some consultants that we know won't give you a hard time.
Yeah. It's a great point that you make about building relationships with them, because, a good studio environment is amazing because you lean on the people around you in the studio for help and advice. But beyond that, if you've got that in a number of consultants that you've worked with for years, and as you say, the client might not want to appoint them yet, but you still might need the guidance. So it's good if you're friendly enough with them to be able to just send them the plans in an email and go, hi mate, how are you doing? Look, I've got this project. Client's not ready yet to appoint yet, but can you give me some dead quick advice? And I guarantee you that when the client is ready to appoint, you'll be the name that's put forward.
We then make a big fuss about... We put the spotlight on them, don't we? And say, look, such and such has given us this advice. Keep them in mind.
Yeah.
That sort of stuff, I think. And being loyal like that, it pays dividends later on as well, doesn't it?
Yeah. Design and access statements. I'm just going to throw that in there.
Since we're staying on stage today, yeah.
Yeah. Just while we've got a bit of time left then, if we're just finishing on this stage... Ours are a mighty document now. They weren't when we first started, but ours can be 60, 70 pages now in the bigger schemes that we do. And they are like just basically a one-stop shop for everyone's work, aren't they? How do you approach them now? So now with your hat on, with all your experience now, how do you approach your design access statements with consultants in mind?
Yeah, just get Rob to do it for me.
Rob Jones. That's Rob Jones. He's made most of the Arcademia templates. I was going to say, you start with a nice Arcademia template, however you say it, and then go from there. I think the chapters that we've made will help other people.
Most important part of a planning app now, would you say, for us?
So the design and access statement is kind of the submission, isn't it, in a way? Because you would appendix your drawings as well. And then you mentioned about using everyone. It doesn't necessarily contain everyone's information, not necessarily, but it's a good document if it does. And the one I liked of yours, Jack, on the Grafton was you'd done these diagrams. I might have rendered them, but they were your diagrams where there was a flip where you went from urban. So the context was white and the building was textured. And then the next section was on landscape. The building was white and the landscape was textured. And it was great, flicking between them. So you could see how they've both, been thought of and went hand in hand.
I think there's a guide on how to write them as well, which we can probably... source for
is
you.
Is it the Cabe one?
The Cabe Garden. Yeah. That tells you, as a bare minimum, what actual headings and topics you need to cover.
Now, I'm
them.
Of the impression that Rob has worked to that.
Yeah.
That's why our sections say scale, layout, appearance, all that other stuff. But yeah, it's good advice though. Go to the Cabe document. I think that might just be a UK thing, but it's still good. It's still good practice.
I like ours, and it's good that we've got templates on the platform, because I think it reminds you.
That's exactly what it is.
Of what consultants you need. So sometimes if you start filling that in early stage three, you'll get to a section and go, oh my God, I haven't got that. And then you need to make sure
ecology.
You go and get it.
So ecology is a good example of that. Where you might need bird boxes, or there's like bee bricks you can do now and all that sort of stuff. I've done housing schemes where you need to set the fencing at a level so hedgehogs can run under it and stuff like that. Like you just wouldn't think of that. in our design access statements, we leave, as you've said there, we leave space for those things. So just it just prompts the mind to go, ooh, have a thought of ecology, have a thought of this and yeah. and whatever. And again, you know, the planners see that. Once they see a document like that with all the right headings and it's got the right assessment in from the right professionals, they look at it and go, these guys are taking it serious.
Yeah.
And you don't half get that back in spades when you do submit it in the right sort of way. So yeah, massive. And that's why we've put the template on Arcademia, because I think we're very proud of it, aren't we? And,
yeah,
it is.
Yeah.
And it's good. And the thing about our templates and our teachings, I have done a little bit of plug on this one, but the reason I'm saying that is it's from our experience, isn't it? And we're seeing good results.
Yeah.
So why, you know, anyone else can use it and hopefully see the same sort of results. So yeah.
Good. Okay. Well, I think if we leave it there for now in terms of we're at the end of stage three. We'll yeah. come back with a part two and we'll run through stage four and five. As you say, four is a big one. It can be split into two as well. Do you want to touch on any of them quickly now? What's coming soon?
I think, yeah. By Warner Brothers.
Join us next time.
So we split stage four into two, don't we? Because there's a misconception about stage four is actually starting on site. So we split it into two. So you get your tender, 4B is 4A is 10, the 4B starts on site, and then 5 is while it's being constructed, construction, you know, that's why it's being constructed. So that's it really. I think it is for another day. It's an hour in its own right, I think.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
Stay
tuned for that.
Yeah. Get your Arcademia merch.
Yeah.
Thanks for watching. We have a project guide coming soon, which will include downloadable consultant list templates. So make sure you're signed up for that. We'll see you next time.